Well, hello, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. I'm Cory Doctorow, and once again, I am reading to you from Bruce Sterling's amazing book, The Hacker Crackdown, his 1992 history of the early years of the civil liberties movement on the internet and the early days of the fight for human rights and civil rights online. It's been a terrific week. This is my first non-travel week since I got back to London in September. And of course, before that, I was traveling for a whole month in Asia and Australia. And before that, I was packing to get going. So this is really my first kind of week here on the ground. And gosh, it's been a good one. One of the things that made it so good was all the fan activity, all the what we call in science fiction fanac around my work, which is always immensely flattering and inspiring. So Peter Anderson wrote a response to my story, Print Crime. He wrote a piece of fan fiction from the copper's point of view, from the policeman's point of view. Print Crime is my story from Nature magazine about the arrest and jailing of a person who prints out trademarked and copyrighted objects using a 3D printer. He rewrote the story from the policeman's point of view and called it The Copper Responds. Scroogled, my story about the day that Google became evil, was translated. Three new translations came up this week. I think that brings the total up to more than a dozen. Two different Italian translations, one from Dicio Biavatti and the other one from Regina Szabo. And then a Portuguese translation from Carlos Martins, and I hear that there are Welsh and Japanese translations coming soon this week, too. And then Kite Dotson wrote a piece of Cory Doctorow fan fiction in which I am the hero, called Hello Cory. It's a very funny little bit starring my alter ego from the XKCD comic strip. That would be me in a set of goggles and a red cape blogging from a hot air balloon. So she wrote this very funny little short story. And Paul Parkinson, another fan, saw that I'd blogged it on Craphound and made a podcast out of it. So there's an MP3. And of course, you know this because I put that in the podcast feed today. So it's just been like a giant parcel of amazing fan act this week. Yesterday, we spent the whole day at hypnobirthing class. This is way less crazy and hippy-dippy than it sounds. It's about using the clinical hypnotherapy techniques that have been used in mainstream medicine for more than a century now help in childbirth, such that the woman doesn't experience as much pain and is very calm and relaxed when the baby's brought into the world. And it was really... it was a really inspiring day. It was very, very nice. And I'm a great believer in clinical hypnotherapy. I've written about this before, but, you know, after spending more than half my life as a very heavy smoker, hypnosis helped me give it up with nary a twinge. And in addition to that, I got over a 5-year bout of writer's block in my mid-20s with hypnotherapy. Really kind of got me over the hump. So yeah, I've really been a great beneficiary of hypnotherapy, and I recognized a lot of the same stuff from the hypnotherapy I'd done before and the self-hypnosis I do sometimes in this class. It was really terrific. So if you're thinking of giving birth, you might try hypnobirthing. This week, my friend Jimmy Wales, who's the founder and kind of grand poobah these days of Wikipedia, is in town in London, and we're working on my next book, which I'm writing with Jimmy. It's called Edit This Book, and it's a book about copyright and about DRM and about wiki-style creativity and how the new flexibilities of the internet that gave rise to Wikipedia are under serious threat from copyright laws that haven't kept up with the times. So it's very exciting to have Jimmy around. We're going to be working our balls off on this, on the book, trying to get the proposal in shape so our agents can shop it around. And I should mention as a last note before I get on with the reading that I am coming to you today from my regular laptop, my little IBM X60. The last couple of weeks I've recorded this on an older laptop because I couldn't get the X60 to work. It's a Linux machine that I bought from a company called Emperor Linux. And Emperor does the amazing job of taking a standard machine and loading Linux on it and pre-configuring it for all your hardware, and then gives you a year of online support. So they will log into your machine remotely, They log in from America while I'm here in London and just fix stuff. So yeah, I could have gotten the kernel patches installed to get the headphones working and played with them and so on, and I probably could have done it without an enormous amount of effort, but gosh, it was really nice to just be able to call up these guys and say, okay, I've opened a tunnel for you, just log in. They give you some software to open that tunnel. Just log in and fix the machine and let me know when it's done, and that's exactly what they did, and now I have a perfectly good working machine, and I no longer have to plug in a second laptop just to record these podcasts, which also means that when I travel with the laptop, not that I'm going to be doing much more travel in the next little while, I'm going to be able to record podcasts as well, which is great news. All right, so this week the reading begins with part 4, The Civil Libertarians. This is my favorite part of this book, and I'm really glad to have gotten to this part at last. Part 4, The Civil Libertarians. The story of the hacker crackdown, as we have followed it thus far, has been technological, subcultural, criminal, and legal. The story of the civil libertarians, though it partakes of all those other aspects, is profoundly and thoroughly political. In 1990, the obscure, long-simmering struggle over the ownership and nature of cyberspace became loudly and irretrievably public. People from some of the oddest corners of American society suddenly found themselves public figures. Some of these people found the situation much more than they had ever bargained for. They backpedaled, tried to retreat back to the Mandarin obscurity of their cozy subcultural niches. This was generally to prove a mistake. But the civil libertarians seized the day in 1990. They found themselves organizing, propagandizing, podium pounding, persuading, touring, negotiating, posing for publicity photos, submitting to interviews, squinting in the limelight as they tried a tentative, but growingly sophisticated, buck and wing upon the public stage. It's not hard to see why the civil libertarians should have this competitive advantage. The hackers of the digital underground are an hermetic elite. They find it hard to make any remotely convincing case for their actions in front of the general public. Actually, hackers roundly despise the ignorant public and have never trusted the judgment of the system. Hackers do propagandize, but only among themselves, mostly in giddy, badly spelled manifestos of class warfare, youth rebellion, or naive techie utopianism. Hackers must strut and boast in order to establish and preserve their underground reputations. But if they speak out too loudly and publicly, they will break the fragile surface tension of the underground, and they will be harassed or arrested. Over the long term, most hackers stumble, get busted, get betrayed, or simply give up. As a political force, the digital underground is hamstrung. The telcos, for their part, are an ivory tower under protracted siege. They have plenty of money with which to push their calculated public image, but they waste much energy and goodwill attacking one another with slanderous and demeaning ad campaigns. The telcos have suffered at the hands of politicians, and, like hackers, they don't trust the public's judgment, and this trust may well be well-founded. Should the general public of the high-tech 1990s come to understand its own best interests in telecommunications, that might well pose a grave threat to the specialized technological power and authority that telcos have relished for over a century. The telcos do have strong advantages: loyal employees, specialized expertise, influence in the halls of power, tactical allies in law enforcement, and unbelievably vast amounts of money. But politically speaking, they lack genuine grassroots support. They simply don't seem to have many friends. Cops know a lot of things other people don't know, but cops willingly reveal only those aspects of their knowledge that they feel will meet their institutional purposes and further public order. Cops have respect, they have responsibilities, they have power in the streets, and even power in the home, but cops don't do particularly well in the limelight. When pressed, they will step out in the public gaze to threaten bad guys, or to cajole prominent citizens, or perhaps to sternly lecture the naive and misguided. But they go back within their time-honored fortress of the station house, the courtroom, and the rulebook. The electronic civil libertarians, however, have proven to be born political animals. They seem to grasp the very early on the postmodern truism that communication is power, publicity is power, soundbites are power. The ability to shove one's issue onto the public agenda and keep it there is power. Fame is power. Simple personal fluency and eloquence can be power if you can somehow catch the public's eye and ear. The civil libertarians had no monopoly on technical power. Though they all owned computers, most were not particularly advanced computer experts. They had a great deal of money, but nowhere near the earth-shaking wealth and galaxy of resources possessed by telcos or federal agencies. They had no ability to arrest people. They carried out no freak and hacker dirty tricks. But they really knew how to network. Unlike the other groups in this book, the civil libertarians have operated very much in the open, more or less right in the public hurly-burly. They have lectured audiences galore and talked to countless journalists, and have learned to refine their spiels. They've kept the cameras clicking, kept those faxes humming, swapped that email, run those photocopiers on overtime, licked envelopes, and spent small fortunes on airfare and long distance. In an information society, this open, overt, obvious activity has proven to be a profound advantage. In 1990, the civil libertarians of cyberspace assembled out of nowhere in particular, at warp speed. This group, actually a networking gaggle of interested parties, which scarcely deserves even that loose term, had almost nothing in the way of formal organization. Those formal civil libertarian organizations which did take an interest in cyberspace issues, mostly the Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility and the American Civil Liberties Union, were carried along by events in 1990 and acted mostly as adjuncts, underwriters, or launching pads. The civil libertarians nevertheless enjoyed the greatest success of any of the groups in the crackdown of 1990. At this writing, their future looks rosy, and the political initiative is firmly in their hands. This should be kept in mind as we study the highly unlikely lives and lifestyles of the people who actually made this happen. In June 1989, Apple Computer Inc. of Cupertino, California had a problem. Someone had illicitly copied a small piece of Apple's proprietary software, software which controlled an internal chip driving the Macintosh screen display. This color quick draw source code was a closely guarded piece of Apple's intellectual property. Only trusted Apple insiders were supposed to possess it. But the new Prometheus League wanted things otherwise. This person, or persons, made several illicit copies of this source code, perhaps as many as 24. He, or she, or they, put those illicit floppy disks into envelopes and mailed them to people all over America. People in the computer industry who were associated with, but not directly employed by, Apple Computer. The new Prometheus caper was a complex, highly ideological, and very hacker-like crime. Prometheus, it will be recalled, stole the fire of the gods and gave this potent gift to the general ranks of downtrodden mankind. A similar god-in-the-manger attitude was implied for the corporate elite of Apple Computer, while the new Prometheus had cast himself in the role of rebel demigod. The illicitly copied data was given away for free. The new Prometheus, whomever he was, escaped the fate of the ancient Greek Prometheus, who was chained to a rock for centuries by the vengeful gods, while an eagle tore and ate his liver. On the other hand, new Prometheus chickened out somewhat by comparison with his role model. The small chunk of color quick draw code he had filched and replicated was more or less useless to Apple's industrial rivals, or in fact, to anyone else. Instead of giving fire to mankind, it was more as if New Prometheus had photocopied the schematics for part of a Bic lighter. The act was not a genuine work of industrial espionage. It was best interpreted as a symbolic, deliberate slap in the face of Apple for the corporate Apple hierarchy. Apple's internal struggles were well known in the industry. Apple's founders, Jobs and Wozniak, had both since taken their leave. Their raucous core of senior employees had been a barnstorming crew of 1960s Californians, many of them markedly less happy with the new button-down multi-million-dollar regime at Apple. Many of the programmers and developers who had invented the Macintosh model in the early 1980s had also taken their leave of the company. It was they, not the current masters of Apple's corporate fate, who had invented the stolen color quick draw code. The new Prometheus stunt was well calculated to wound company morale. Apple called the FBI. The Bureau takes an interest in high-profile intellectual property theft cases, industrial espionage, and theft of trade secrets. They were the right people to call, and rumor has it that the entities responsible were in fact discovered by the FBI, then quietly squelched by Apple management. New Prometheus was never publicly charged with a crime, or prosecuted, or jailed. But there were no further illicits of Macintosh internal software. Eventually, the painful issue of New Prometheus was allowed to fade. In the meantime, however, a large number of puzzled bystanders found themselves entertaining surprised guests from the FBI. One of these people was John Perry Barlow. Barlow is a most unusual man, difficult to describe in conventional terms. He is perhaps best known as a songwriter for the Grateful Dead, for he composed lyrics for Hell in a Bucket, Picasso Moon, Mexicali Blues, I Need a Miracle, and many more. He has been writing for the band since 1970. Before we tackle the vexing question as to why a rock lyricist should be interviewed by the FBI in a computer crime case, it might be well to say a word or two about the Grateful Dead. The Grateful Dead are perhaps the most successful and long-lasting of the numerous cultural emanations from the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco in the glory days of movement politics and lysergic transcendence. The Grateful Dead are a nexus, a veritable whirlwind of appliqué decals, psychedelic vans, tie-dyed t-shirts, earth-colored denim, frenzied dancing, and open and unashamed drug use. The symbols and the realities of Californian freak power surround the Grateful Dead like knotted macrame. The Grateful Dead and their thousands of Deadhead devotees are radical bohemians. This much is widely understood. Exactly what this implies in the 1990s is rather more problematic. The Grateful Dead are among the world's most popular and wealthy entertainers, number 20, according to Forbes magazine, right behind MC Hammer and Sean Connery. In 1990, this jeans-clad group of purported raffish outcasts earned $17 million. They have been earning sums much along this line for quite some time now. And while the Dead are not investment bankers or three-piece suit tax specialists, they are, in point of fact, hippie musicians. This money has not been squandered in senseless bohemian excess. The Dead have been quietly active for many years, funding various worthy activities in their extensive and widespread cultural community. The Grateful Dead are not conventional players in the American power establishment. They nevertheless are something of a force to be reckoned with. They have a lot of money and a lot of friends in many places, both likely and unlikely. The Dead may be known for back-to-the-earth environmentalist rhetoric, but this hardly makes them anti-technological Luddites. On the contrary, like most rock musicians, the Grateful Dead have spent their entire adult lives in the company of complex electronic equipment. They have funds to burn on any sophisticated tool and toy that might happen to catch their fancy. And their fancy is quite extensive. The Deadhead community boasts any number of recording engineers, lighting experts, rock video mavens, electronic technicians of all descriptions. And the drift goes both ways. Steve Wozniak, Apple's co-founder, used to throw rock festivals. Silicon Valley rocks out. These are the 1990s, not the 1960s. Today, for a surprising number of people all over America, the supposed dividing line between bohemian and technician simply no longer exists. People of this sort may have set wind chimes and a dog with a knotted kerchief may have a set of wind chimes and a dog with a knotted kerchief round its neck, but they're also quite likely to own a multi-megabyte Macintosh running MIDI synthesizer software and trippy fractal simulations. These days, even Timothy Leary himself, prophet of LSD, does virtual reality computer graphics demos on his lecture tours. John Perry Barlow is not a member of the Grateful Dead. He is, however, a ranking Deadhead. Barlow describes himself as a techno-crank. A vague term like social activist may not be far from the mark either. But Barlow may better be described as a poet, if one keeps in mind Percy Shelley's archaic definition as poets as the unacknowledged legislators of the world. Barlow once made a stab at acknowledged legislator status. In 1987, he narrowly missed the Republican nomination for a seat in the Wyoming State Senate. Barlow is a Wyoming native, the third-generation scion of a well-to-do cattle ranching family. He is in his early 40s, married, and the father of three daughters. Barlow is not much troubled by other people's narrow notions of consistency. In the late 1980s, this Republican rock lyricist cattle rancher sold his ranch and became a computer telecommunications devotee. The free-spirited Barlow made this transition with ease. He genuinely enjoyed computers. With a beep of his modem, he leapt from small-town Pinedale, Wyoming, into an electronic contact with a large and lively crowd of bright, inventive technological sophisticates from all over the world. Barlow found the social milieu of computing attractive, its fast lane pace, its blue-sky rhetoric, its open-endedness. Barlow began dabbling in computer journalism with marked success, and he was a quick study, and both shrewd and eloquent. He frequently traveled to San Francisco to network with Deadhead friends. There, Barlow made extensive contacts throughout the Californian computer community, including friendships among the wilder spirits at Apple. In May 1990, Barlow received a visit from a local Wyoming agent of the FBI. The new Prometheus case had reached Wyoming. Barlow was troubled to find himself under investigation in an area of his interests once quite free of federal attention. He had to struggle to explain the very nature of computer crime to a head-scratching local FBI man who specialized in cattle rustling. Barlow, chatting helpfully and demonstrating the wonders of his modem to this puzzled Fed, was alarmed to find all hackers generally under FBI suspicion as an evil influence in the electronic community. The FBI, in pursuit of a hacker called New Prometheus, were tracing attendees of a suspect group called the Hackers Conference. The Hackers Conference, which had started in 1984, was a yearly Californian meeting of digital pioneers and enthusiasts. The hackers of the Hackers Conference had little, if anything, to do with the hackers of the digital underground. On the contrary, the hackers of this conference were mostly well-to-do Californian high-tech CEOs, consultants, journalists, and entrepreneurs. This group of hackers were the exact sort of hackers most likely to react with militant fury at any criminal degradation of the term hacker. Barlow, though he was not arrested or accused of a crime, and through his computer had certainly not gone out the door, was very troubled by this anomaly. He carried the word to the well. Like the Hackers Conference, the well was an emanation of the Point Foundation. Point Foundation, the inspiration of a wealthy Californian 60s radical named Stuart Brand, was to be a major launchpad of the civil libertarian effort. Point Foundation's cultural efforts, like those of their fellow Bay Area Californians, the Grateful Dead, are multifaceted and multitudinous. Rigid ideological consistency has never been a strong suit of the Whole Earth catalog. This Point publication has enjoyed a strong vogue during the late 1960s and early 1970s, when it offered hundreds of practical and not-so-practical tips on communitarian living, environmentalism, and getting back to the land. The Whole Earth catalog and its sequels sold 2.5 million copies and won a National Book Award. With the slow collapse of American radical dissent, the Whole Earth catalog had slipped to a more modest corner of the cultural radar, but in its magazine incarnation, Coevolution Quarterly, the Point Foundation continued to offer a magpie potpourri of access to tools and ideas. Coevolution Quarterly, which started in 1974, was never a widely popular magazine. Despite periodic outbreaks of millenarian fever, Coevolution Quarterly failed to revolutionize Western civilization and replaced leaden centuries of history with bright new Californian paradigms. Instead, this propaganda arm of Point Foundation cakewalked a fine line between impressive brilliance and New Age flakiness. Coevolution Quarterly carried no advertising, cost a lot, and came out on cheap newsprint with modest black and white graphics. It was poorly distributed and spread mostly by subscription and word of mouth. It could not seem to grow beyond 30,000 subscribers, and yet it never seemed to shrink much either. Year in, year out, decade in, decade out, some strange demographic minority accreted to support the magazine. The enthusiastic readership did not have much in the way of coherent politics or ideals. It was sometimes hard to understand what held them together, if the often bitter debate in the letters column could be described as togetherness. But if the magazine did not flourish, it was resilient. It got by. Then, in 1984, the birth year of the Macintosh computer, Coevolution Quarterly suddenly hit the rapids. Point Foundation had discovered the computer revolution. Out came the Whole Earth Software Catalog of 1984, arousing head-scratching doubts among the tie-dyed faithful and rabid enthusiasm among the nascent cyberpunk milieu, present company included. Point Foundation started its yearly Hackers Conference and began to take an extensive interest in the strange new possibilities of digital counterculture. Coevolution Quarterly folded its teepee, replaced by the Whole Earth Software Review, and eventually by Whole Earth Review, the magazine's present incarnation, currently under the editorship of virtual reality maven Howard Rheingold. 1985 saw the birth of The Well, the Whole Earth Electronic Link. The Well was Point Foundation's bulletin board system. As boards went, The Well was an anomaly from the beginning and remained one. It was local to San Francisco. It was huge, with multiple phone lines and enormous files of commentary. Its complex Unix-based software might be most charitably described as user-opaque. It was run on a mainframe out of the rambling offices of a non-profit cultural foundation in Sausalito, and it was crammed with fans of the Grateful Dead. Though the Well was peopled by chattering hipsters of the Bay Area counterculture, it was by no means a digital underground. Teenagers were fairly scarce. Most Well users, known as well-beings, were 30 and 40-something baby boomers. They tended to work in the information industry, hardware, software, telecommunications, media, entertainment. Librarians, academics, and journalists were especially common on the Well, attracted by the Point Foundation's open-handed distribution of tools and ideas. There were no anarchy files on the Well. Scarcely drop a hint about access code or credit card theft. No one used handles. Vicious flame wars were held to a comparatively civilized rumble. Debates were sometimes sharp, but no well-being ever claimed that a rival had disconnected his phone, trashed his house, or posted his credit card numbers. The Well grew slowly as the 1980s advanced. It charged a modest sum for access and storage and lost money for years, but not enough to hamper the Poit Foundation, which was non-profit anyways. By 1990, the Well had about 5,000 users. These users wandered about a gigantic cyberspace smorgasbord of conferences, and each conference itself consisting of a welter of topics, each topic containing dozens, sometimes hundreds of comments in a tumbling, multi-person debate that could last for months or years on end. In 1991, the Well's list of conferences looked like this. Conferences on the Well. Well Screenzine Digest, G-Zine. Best of the Well, Vintage Material, G-Best. Index listing new topics in all conferences, G-Newtops. Business and Education. Apple Library Users Group, G-Alug. Agriculture, G-Agri. Brainstorming, G-Brain. Classifieds, G-Claw. Computer Journalism, G-CG. Consultants, G-Consult. Consumers, G-Cons. Design, G-Design. Desktop Publishing, G-Desk. Disability, G-Disability. Education, G-Ed. Energy, G-Energy 91. Entrepreneurs, G-Entre. Homeowners, G-Home. Indexing, G-Indexing. Investments, G-Invest. Kids 91, G-Kids. Legal, G-Legal. One-person business, G-1. Periodical newsletter, G-Per. Telecom law, G-TCL. The future, G-Fute. Translators, G-Trans. Travel, G-Tra. Work, G-Work. Electronic Frontier Foundation, G-EFF. Computers Freedom and Privacy, GCFP, Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility, GCPSR, Social Political Humanities, Aging, G. Gray, AIDS, G. AIDS, Amnesty International, G. Amnesty, Archives, G. Arc, Berkeley, G. Burke, Buddhist, G. Wonderland, Christian, G. Cross, Couples, G. Couples, Current Events, G. Kerr, Dreams, G. Dreams, Drugs, G. Drew, East Coast, G. East, Emotional Health, G. Private, Erotica, G. Eros, Environment, G. Env, Firearms, G. Firearms, First Amendment, G. First, Fringes of Reason, G. Fringes, Gay, G. Gay, Private, Gay, Private, G. Gay, Private, Holistic, G. Holly, Interview, G. Inter, Italian, G. Ital, Jewish, G. Jew, Liberty, G. Liberty, Mind, G. Mind, Miscellaneous, G. Misc, Men on the Well, G. MOW, Network Integration, G. Origin, Nonprofits, G. Non, North Bay, G. North, Northwest, GNW, Pacific Rim, G. Pac Rim, Parenting, G. Par, Peace, G. Pia, Peninsula, G. Pen, Poetry, G. Poetry, Philosophy, G. Phi, Politics, G. Paul, Psychologies, G. Psy, Psychotherapy, G. Therapy, Recovery, G. Recovery, San Francisco, G. San Fran, Scams, G. Scam, Sexuality, G. Sex, Singles, G. Singles, Southern, G. South, Spanish, G. Spanish, Spirituality, G. Spirit, Tibet, G. Tibet, Transportation, G. Transport, True Confessions, G. True, Unclear, G. Unclear, Well Writers Workshop, G. WWW, Whole Earth, G. WE, Women on the Well, G. Wow, Words, G. Words, Writers, G. Rye, Arts, Recreation, and Entertainment, Artcom ElectronicNet, G. Assen, Audio Videophilia, G. Odd, Bicycles, G. Bike, Bay Area Tonight, G. Bat, Boating, G. Wet, Books, G. Books, CDs, G. CD, Comics, G. Comics, Cooking, G. Cook, Flying, G. Flying, Fun, G. Fun, Games, G. Games, Gardening, G. Guard, Kids, G. Kids, Night Owls, G. Owl, Jokes, G. Jokes, MIDI, G. MIDI, Movies, G. Movies, Motorcycle, G. Ride, G. Motoring, G. Car, Music, G. Mus, Onstage, G. Onstage, Pets, G. Pets, Radio, G. Rad, Restaurant, G. Rest, Science Fiction, G. SF, Sports, G. Spo, Star Trek, G. Trek, Television, GTV, Theater, G Theater, Weird, G Weird, Zines, / Factsheet 5, GF5. Grateful Dead, Grateful Dead GGD, Deadplant GDP, Deadlit GD Deadlit, Feedback G Feedback, GD Hour GD GDH, Tapes G Tapes, Tickets G Ticks, Tours G Tours. Computers, AI / 4th / Realtime, G Realtime, Amiga G Amiga, Apple G App, Computer Books G Seabook, Arts and Graphics, G Graw, Hacking G Hack, Hypercard G Hype, IBM PC G IBM, LANs G LAN, Laptop G Lap, Macintosh G Mac, Mac Tech G Mac Tech, Microtimes G Microx, Mucho Media G Mucho, Next G Next, OS2 G OS2, Printers G Print, Programmers Net G Net, SIGGRAPH G SIGGRAPH, Software Design G SDC, Software Programming G Software, Software Support GSSC, Unix, G Unix, Windows, G Windows, Word Processing, G Word, Technical Communications, BioInfo, G BioInfo, Info, G Boing, Media, G Media, NAPLPS, G NAPLPS, NetWeaver, G NetWeaver, NetWorld, G NetWorld, Packet Radio, G Packet, Photography, G Pho, Radio, G Rad, Science, G Science, Technical Writers, G Tech, Telecommunications, G Tele, Usenet, G Usenet, Video, G Vid, Virtual Reality, G VR, The Well Itself, Deeper, G Deeper, Entry, G Ent, General, G Gentech, Help, G Help, Host, G Host, Police, G Policy, System News, G News, Test, G Test. The list itself is dazzling, bringing to the untutored eye a dizzying impression of a bizarre milieu of mountain-climbing Hawaiian holistic photographers trading true-life confessions with bisexual word-processing Tibetans. But this confusion is more apparent than real. Each of these conferences was like a little cyberspace world in itself, comprising dozens and perhaps hundreds of subtopics. Each conference was commonly frequented by a fairly small, fairly like-minded community of perhaps a dozen people. It was humanly impossible to encompass the entire well, especially since access to the well's mainframe computer was billed by the hour. Most long-time users contented themselves with a few favorite topical neighborhoods, with the occasional foray elsewhere for a taste of exotica. But especially important news items and hot topical debates could catch the attention of the entire well community. Like any community, the well had its celebrities, and John Perry Barlow, the silver-tongued and silver-modemed lyricist of the Grateful Dead, ranked prominently among them. It was here on the well that Barlow posted his true-life tale of computer crime encounter with the FBI. The story, as might be expected, created a great stir. The well was already primed for hacker controversy. In December 1989, Harper's Magazine had hosted a debate on the well about the ethics of illicit computer intrusion. While over 40 various computer mavens took part, Barlow proved a star in the debate. So did Acid Freak and Fiber Optic, a pair of young New York hacker freaks whose skills at telco switching station intrusion were only matched by their apparently limitless hunger for fame. The advent of these two boldly swaggering outlaws in the precincts of the well created a sensation akin to that of Black Panthers at a cocktail party for the radically chic. Fiber Optic, in particular, was to seize the day in 1990. A devotee of the 2600 Circle and stalwart of the New York hackers group Masters of Deception, Fiber Optic was a splendid exemplar of the computer intruder as committed dissident. The 18-year-old Optic, a high school dropout and part-time computer repairman, was young, smart, and ruthlessly obsessive, a sharp-dressing, sharp-talking digital dude who was utterly and airily contemptuous of anyone's rules but his own. By late 1991, Fiber Optic had appeared in Harper's, Esquire, The New York Times, in countless public debates and conventions, and even on a television show hosted by Geraldo Rivera. Treated with gingerly respect by Barlow and other well mavens, Fiber Optic swiftly became a well celebrity. Strangely, despite his thorny attitude and utter single-mindedness, Fiber Optic seemed to arouse strong protective instincts in most of the people who met him. He was great copy for journalists, always fearlessly ready to swagger, and better yet, to actually demonstrate some off-the-wall digital stunt. He was a born media darling. Even cops seemed to recognize that there was something peculiarly unworldly and uncriminal about this particular troublemaker. He was so bold, so flagrant, so young, and so obviously doomed, that even those who strongly disapproved of his actions grew anxious for his welfare and began to flutter about him as if he were an endangered seal pup. In January 24, 1990, 9 days after the Martin Luther King Day crash, Fiber Optic, Acid Freak, and a third New York City scofflaw named Scorpion were raided by the Secret Service. Their computers went out the door, along with the usual blizzard of papers, notebooks, compact discs, answering machines, Sony Walkmans, etc. Both Acid Freak and Fiber Optic were accused of having caused the crash.